Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is Angelia Miller with Adrenaline Living. Have you ever heard of the psychology of travel? Michael Bryan first coined the term in 1965 during his graduate studies and is now known as the travel psychologist, perhaps one of the very few in the world today. Michael will give you his particular psychological spin on all things travel, and get ready for his forthcoming book, Traveling, The Everyday Psychology of Travel and Adventure, essentially a book of travel tales about the psychology of travel as it weaves its way through the incredible travel stories of 1,500 world travelers and adventurers. And so as we always like to do with these shows is get a bit of background on our guests and find out how they came into their unique entrepreneurial. So let's find out how you came into this. Did you come from a family of travelers or?
No, ironically not. Nobody in my family really liked to travel all that much, although my parents did their honeymoon in Cuba in the early days when you could go to Cuba. But I started out a high school trip to Mexico, and that's when the bug got to me, and I never stopped traveling ever since.
Now, you said that you went down to Cuba.
No, my parents did on their honeymoon.
Your parents did. Okay.
Yeah.
So your first time that you went traveling, how was that for you? What bells and whistles went off for you that made you start on this path?
Well, it was just fascinating to have the experience of being outside your own culture and country for the first time. And I took a lot of home movies in those days. And I remember one incident that was very funny, and that is I was standing on the steps of a museum, and I think a Mexican vendor with tourist items kept approaching me. And then as he approached, I would move away because he would get so close into my personal space, which was really uncomfortable for me. So I'd back off and he'd move forward. And basically Latin cultures, it's known generally that people have a closer personal space. So they're in your face, so to speak, and that's comfortable for them, but it's not always that comfortable for you. So I look back on this home movie, and it's just roaring with laughter, anybody that sees it. And that got me all started in the whole idea of cultural differences, similarities and differences between people from different countries, and I just really got fascinated with that. And I was on my path to becoming a clinical psychologist, actually, on the East Coast of the United States, wearing a suit and tie and jacket every day, and then suddenly Hawaii loomed in the distance, and I thought, well, why don't I go do my doctorate at the University of Hawaii instead of in Pennsylvania? And that got me going. So I got to Hawaii, and I took all kinds of subjects that had to do with intercultural communication and the psychology of spatial behavior, started studying a lot of different foreign languages and just got hooked on it. Meanwhile, I've been traveling around the world and having great adventures myself.
You know, you were talking about the personal space issues, and I can remember being in Europe and sitting on on the public transportation and looking over, and I was sitting there in the seat all by myself, and then I must have been looking out the window and you know, kind of marveling at the sights and whatnot. And then when I looked back over, I noticed there was a small family of Italian people.
A small family,
you say. A small family, because the seat wasn't very big. And so, yes, certain cultures have there's no such a thing as personal space. You also get that in Asia too. So it's really hilarious how that happens. But let's talk about some other differences culturally with people around the world. That was one.
Okay, I want to give you another personal space item because it's interesting to Americans. And that is, you know, when we go into a restaurant or a coffee shop, and we sit down at a table, guess what? We own that table, don't we? You know, it's our table. Nobody can intrude unless we want them to, but not so around the world. You sit at a table often in Europe, and you'll find other people sit right down at the table with you. Now, I'm not talking about, a small table in a restaurant. That usually is your own table. But, you know, where there are larger tables and public areas, people will sit right down there with you. And if you're not prepared for that, you're going to really feel like they're intruding on your space. You do not own the tables in Europe and other places around the world. So that's okay. Other cultural differences. Well, there's the funny thing where you're asking directions. Maybe you're in your car and somebody is trying to signal to you, follow me. But the signal for follow me, and this is in a number of European countries I've seen this, it happens to be our signal of go away. So you think, well, what are they doing? They're telling us to go away? Or they want us to follow them. So gestures are often very, very different around the world. You know the shaka symbol in Hawaii where you have your little finger and your thumb protruding and you shake it, and that is a very welcoming, friendly gesture in Hawaii. Most of us who have been to Hawaii have certainly seen this. It's called shaka. But that shaka gesture is not the same thing in every place in the world. It sometimes is a very lewd gesture of get lost. So you have to be careful about your gestures overseas.
Well, that was a very nice way of putting it.
Doesn't always mean aloha.
Well, let's talk about it because I'm looking on the website and he does very much so, you know, he's dressing like Indiana Jones in the large floppy fedora and the clothing and dusty clothing and all of that. So he's quite a character. And also when he goes out for book signings as well. So, and you can see that when you go out there to his website. But let's talk a little bit about some of the adventures that you have had. We talked about your first taste of an adventure, but what was your first actual out-of-the-country experience?
Well, I remember being in France with two college buddies. They weren't quite as traveled as I was, and I was more open to new things and willing to expand my envelope or personal bubble. But these friends, unfortunately, carried their psychological, I call them psycho bubbles, with them from the United States to France. So we found ourselves in southern France in a restaurant, and, we'll try something new on the menu. Let's have steak tartare. Now, I don't know if you know what steak tartare is or the listening audience, but it could be, it's certainly raw meat mixed with mustard, beef often, but it could be horse meat. You know, you can never be certain of that. But so they brought this to our table, and I looked at that. Well, this is curious. I certainly want to try this and see how it tastes. And immediately my friends saw red, and they said, "We will not eat raw meat. You must take this meat back and have it cooked. Do not serve us raw meat." And, of course, I was really embarrassed, and I wanted to crawl under the table. But I tasted this. And it was delicious. And I choose not to, I didn't know whether it was beef or horse meat, to be really honest with you. But I did taste zebra meat once. And I'll tell you what, it tasted very different from beef. But anyway, steak tartare is a very French dish, and it's delicious. I was willing to try it, but my friends caused a great scene in the restaurant. I have another France food story that I like to tell. And I was sitting in a restaurant opposite the Gare du Nord, or the Paris North train station, and I saw on the menu fruits de la mer, fruits of the sea. Now, I had a rough idea what that was. It was snails, you know. And a lot of Americans are a little bit cautious about eating snails, but a lot of us like and are familiar with escargot, you know. But Fruits de la Mer was a huge, huge tray of I would say 100 different shells of all different kinds filled with seafood. And of course, then the thought occurred to me, oh my God, we're supposed to be careful about eating shellfish. And here I was facing the prospect of more than 100 varieties of shellfish of all different kinds, including snails and seafoods. And they put a bib on me, and I felt like the gourmand. If you can picture somebody with a huge bib with a fork in one hand and a knife in the other, and hundreds of shells piled on this heap. So I ate this, and I thought this was going to be my last day on the planet, because certainly one of these shells is going to make me sick and maybe kill me, you know. And I thought, gosh, I'm going to have nightmares. This is going to be terrible. But I ate the whole thing. It was delicious. Loved it. And I saw a Frenchman walking outside the restaurant, look in the window, see me eating this huge plate of shellfish and giving me the facial gesture of, the gourmand pigging out on this dish. And I was so self-conscious, I thought I was not only the only person eating this, but I was the only tourist eating this, and thought maybe it was some kind of a joke. But I saw somebody else have the same platter. And then I had no nightmares that night, and I woke up alive the next day, and just loved the experience of that food.
You know, you talked about zebra meat, so I guess we are now curious about how zebra meat tastes.
Well, I'm not sure I ever really ate horse meat, but I want to tell you that it was tough, and I'll never eat it again. But the experience was phenomenal. There's a chain of restaurants. There's actually two restaurants. They're called the Carnivore. What an appropriate name, huh? The Carnivore was in Johannesburg. No, I'm sorry. It was in Nairobi. I was in Nairobi. Took a taxi to the Carnivore, and not only did they have the normal meats and salads and so on and so forth, but they had special game meats from Africa, which was amazing. So the night that I was there, they served giraffe. It certainly wasn't in the shape of a giraffe, but it was like on a skewer. They brought this by, and they would slice off a little taste of this and other game meats, and they would vary these from night to night. And I tried this, and I felt bad about eating giraffe, but I know that they raise these animals strictly for the restaurant. They have another one of these restaurants in Cape Town. So, you know, you have to be prepared to try new foods. And, you know, all over the world people eat things that you would think are strange, and you eat things that they would think are strange. And it's really one of the wonderful excitements of travel, is to be willing, again, to expand the envelope, to venture outside of your security envelope and try new things. You know,
absolutely.
And,
we had a lady that ate a slug, and she was telling me about the taste of the slug, and it had to be toasted because otherwise it would be completely disgusting.
That sounds like the Mopani worm from I've had those Mopani worms, and they're crisp, and they actually taste pretty good, you know, when they're crisp. I wouldn't want them when they're juicy. But where did I have this? It was in Victoria Falls in one of the restaurants. Where you would go cafeteria style and pick out foods, and they had the Mopani worms, and they were good. It was fun to try them.
So it was cafeteria style, and in the cafeteria style there were worms. What else was in the cafeteria style? Was it regular food that most Americans would recognize, or were there some interesting delicacies mixed in?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I can't really recall any other specifics, but definitely they introduce you to African foods, which were really delicious. And here's a fun experience I want to tell you about. I've had the opportunity to go on a number of photographic safaris. And it's funny, I say society because it's almost a Freudian slip. These were pretty high-priced 4-star experiences where you go out into the bush and you stay in a deluxe tent, and these native African chefs literally dig a hole in the ground, all right, and they put coals, whatever, in, and out of that hole in the ground comes a 4-star dining experience, as good as any 4-star restaurant you will find around the world. The food was superb, from your entrees to your appetizers and to desserts. They would create cakes. They would create everything imaginable. These chefs that I met out in the African bush were every bit as good as their counterparts in the 3-star French restaurants, Michelin 3-star restaurants. They were so good, and the food was so delicious.
Well, you know,
you wouldn't think you should have that experience out on a safari, but you do. But you do get dirty and dusty. You get dirty and dusty and hot and even cold early in the morning on these game drives, and it is just a wonderful, memorable experience.
Well, let's talk about some of those game drives, because you did mention some safaris on your website. So let's talk about some of your experiences out there.
Well, I want to tell you, I think at the outset, I want to say that one person's white knuckle experience is another person's adventure. So I've always wondered, was it safe to go canoeing on the Zambezi River? So I went to this place in an area called Mana Pools in Zimbabwe, and it was an area specifically called Chikwenye. And I won't even bother spelling it, but it was a beautiful tented safari camp out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and just starkly, starkly beautiful. And on that particular day, there were some British journalists visiting who were going to look at this tented camp, and they were going to write about it. They were going to write about their experiences. So into my canoe comes one of these journalists, and he and I sat out, and there were two other canoes, and he knew less about canoeing than I did. And the guide was in one of the canoes, and before we know it, those two canoes are way out ahead of us down the river, and here is the bumbling British journalist and myself. The canoe goes in circles. We land up on the bank with barbs coming at us from bushes, and slowly we are now beginning to drift towards a pod of hippos. Now, hippos are one of the most dangerous animals in Africa. And I have to tell you, I got to the point where the canoe was so close to the hippos that I was asking myself if I was going to panic or if I was going to keep it together and get out of there. And just then the African guide from one of the canoes way down yells, "Put your oars in the water and paddle, paddle, paddle." And that's exactly what I did, and I avoided eye contact with the hippos. And it was the scariest moment of my life then, and now it is one of the most memorable of my personal adventures. So excitement, yeah, and fascination, and having danger. Now, you talk about adrenaline rush, because I know your blog has adrenaline in the title of it. Let me tell you that adrenaline and excitement, fear and excitement, are two sides of the same coin. And the most exciting adventure is where you can experience the most risk of danger while still being safe. But at the time you're having that adventure, you don't always think of yourself as being safe. And I know people have been killed by hippos, and they've been killed by hippos on that Zambezi River. Now, not to scare half of your listening audience, by thinking that it's very dangerous to do these things. It's very rare that anything will ever happen, but you still have to be circumspect and prudent and evaluate risks to some extent, you know?
Absolutely. And they do say that when you're in that sort of collective group, they view you as a large animal. And so anytime you try to get outside of that or try to make a move from that vehicle or boat or whatever it is that you're in at the time, then that is what alerts, you know, them and you know, makes them uneasy and makes them want to charge. But, you know,
exactly. And guess what? They don't take Visa or American Express. they charge you, and we were a group of one because the other canoes were way down ahead. And I want to just talk about another notion that I've noticed that Americans tend to have, which we really have to think about, and that is there's a certain tendency of Americans to, and this will sound a bit ironic, but there's a certain tendency for us to accept authority without questioning it. And I'd like to give you, may I give you two examples of that?
Go ahead.
Okay, the first example is that when somebody says that he or she is a guide, we tend to kind of accept that without thinking about it. And although I'm sure that this particular guide on this canoeing trip was very competent, I think that, and as I later learned, he was competent, but I think that he had a momentary slip by leaving us behind and moving a bit too quickly away from the rest of us while we were, kind of alone, and he should have paid more attention. But there was a time when I interviewed a couple who were climbing up volcanoes in Guatemala, and they had a guide. He said, "Let me be your guide for the day. You know, I'm a guide. I know how to do this. So this is my business." And so this guide takes them up, and the guide gets lost. They're all lost, and the guide is lost. And it's getting dark, and the guide says, "Oh, I can take you down from the mountain. We'll just go down the mountain. Don't worry. I'm a guide. I know what I'm doing." And they said they absolutely refused. They said, "No, we're not going anywhere until morning." Morning came, light came, and guess what? There were sheer cliffs all over the place. So if they had followed that guide's advice, they would have lost their lives in that case. I want to give you one other example of, I like to call this, your papers, please. Very often you're on a train, you're in Europe. In this case, this was, I think, in Eastern Europe during the, I'm not sure if it was the pre-Soviet era or during the Soviet era or post-Soviet era, but these people were on a train, and you know, if you have train experience, you know that people come knocking on the door at all times of night. You don't know who they are. They're police, customs officials, border people. You never know, right? So in this case, here comes one official knocking on the door. They open the door, and he says, "Your papers, please. I want to see your passports." So what does he do? The tourist, American tourist, pulls out the pouch, the neck pouch, right in front of this official, pulls out his passport. The official looks at the passport, hands it back. Thank you. And he walks on. The next day, they wake up, and he discovers that his pouch is missing from his neck, but his girlfriend's purse was still with her. She was sleeping on it, but she didn't show the purse to the so-called official. And apparently they were gassed with some kind of sleeping gas. It happens once in a while. It happened, I heard that it happened fairly frequently between Barcelona and southern France and the European Riviera, probably in second or third class cars, not so much in first class. And this doesn't happen again that often, but it can happen, and it has happened. And I don't want to scare your listeners, but I'm talking about incidents that are rare but do happen. And again, this was a case of Americans being too willing to trust authority just because the people said they were authority or they were experts or guides. So we have to overcome that tendency to be that way, whereas other world travelers and Europeans might be a little more circumspect about that, about accepting that.
Wow. You know, I'm glad that you brought that up because I had found a great article out there about some of the really bad experiences that people have had traveling around the world, dealing with people who were very shysty and thieves and criminals and whatnot. And I think now would be a great time to kind of get into a few of the stories, a few more of the stories. That way we kind of are able to keep our eyes open and know how to handle ourselves when we're away from home.
Yes, very good. And I want to do a little experiment with our listeners right now, so give me a second, okay? And tell me what you hear. They can't see this, but they can hear this. What did you hear? Okay, I'll tell you. I drop a set of keys on the tabletop, okay? Now, I want to imagine the whole listening audience, 99% of you in your minds are probably looking at those keys, imagining the keys on the tabletop. Is that fair? Is that fair to say? Maybe. Well, I do this. Every time I give a lecture, the first thing I do is I accidentally knock keys, maybe a plastic bottle of water, with my elbow off the podium, and it falls on the floor, and I look around, and I see that 99% of the people looked to where the keys fell onto the floor. And I ask them to raise your hands if you looked at the keys. Okay? And most of the hands go up, and they have sheepish looks. Now, I want to be careful that I didn't lose the phone call with you. Are you there? Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. So they sheepishly raise their hands and admit they looked at the keys. And this is precisely what happens often in pickpocketing situations. And what happened to me was that I was standing in the middle of a Madrid Metro subway car, right in the middle, and I had my arms full of posters and things around my shoulders and this and that. And I was a victim in waiting, standing there. I was a total victim. And suddenly I noticed that my jeans were scuffed on my left pant leg. Somebody's foot had accidentally scuffed my jeans, and the guy was seated in a bench next to where I was, and he took his hand and he grabbed the jeans and he started scuffing them, you know, rhythmically and systematically and hypnotically. And what did I do? What did I do? I looked at the jeans. I looked at him trying to clean the scuff that he made on my jeans apologetically. And so I was distracted. And that's the key dropping, is a distraction. I looked over there and kind of watched him cleaning the jeans. And then in the back of my mind, I just noticed there was a couple people behind me. And I slowly turned around and I saw these two guys standing behind me. And these three guys looked the same. They were Spanish gypsies, so they were a little darker complected than other Spaniards. And I still didn't know what was happening. You know, it was sort of below the level, just below the level of consciousness. And I looked around. I looked at each of them in the eyes. And I knew something was up, but I didn't know what it was. But the train stopped, the door opened, and the three of them dashed out of there as quickly as possible. And the one that was seated on the bench and the two behind me, because they knew that I was aware of them, even though I wasn't really conscious at that instant exactly what was going on. And suddenly I realized, I was a pickpocketing victim. But you know what? I had a safari jacket with like 22 pockets in it, and they got nothing. They got absolutely nothing. But the whole day long, I kept feeling all my pockets, you know, feeling violated, feeling like they got something. I saw the same gang later on in another Metro car, and this time they dropped keys on the floor.
Yeah,
to,
as a distraction. Yeah, I something because they do travel in groups. They don't have to be dark-looking gypsies because
they get
pocketed by your by Europe, other European people as well. So you just have to keep an eye
absolutely
out for everybody, because I've heard so many stories about people, you know, being distracted about this and then getting pickpocketed. And I was in Prague not too long ago, and, you know, if you don't keep your eye, you know, somebody, you know, one of the people from Prague will come along and try to pick up your luggage or or whatnot as well. So I just want to make sure that everybody knows that you do need, it's not home. You need to make sure that you're aware of your things and keeping up with stuff. But go ahead, because thank you. That's important to know that, you know, they're making distractions.
I wanted to say that I'm, you know, it's funny because it sounds like I was profiling. That particular incident in Madrid, I happened to mention that these three guys did happen to look very similar and a little different from everybody else. But, of course, anybody is capable of doing this, any race, religion, person that you can imagine. There are elements among them who are pickpockets, and that's how they make their living. And I want to say, did you ever notice the Secret Service, every time they're with the president, if you look at the Secret Service agents, you'll notice a certain kind of behavior that they exhibit, and that is they sort of look around, like if you can imagine the clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock. They're always rotating their gaze in a circular fashion so as to break the, almost in a sense, the monotony of the gaze. Because if you look in one direction and you look long enough, you know, you begin to really see less. So you break your gaze and you scan your surroundings around you, in front of you, on your sides, behind.